Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Richard Amofa of The Athletic, and Paul Haywood, the author and columnist. Liverpool are, by common consent, Manchester City's closest challengers. They have an inspirational manager, iconic players, and an innovative strategy based on the application of science. Their owners, the Fenway Sports Group, are valued at around $7.5 billion. Yet the factors that prompted SSG to support the Super League are more pronounced than ever. Now, Paul, this might sound ridiculous, but as we look forward from this age of state-funded clubs, is Liverpool's combination of assets, both human and financial, going to be enough to win the biggest prizes?
Well, I think they are slightly clinging on to that equality they've had with Manchester City over the past few seasons. They're starting to push their luck a bit now in the sense that they're heavily reliant on Jurgen Klopp's genius as a manager, and they're heavily dependent still on the excellent transfer dealings of the last 5 years. You know, the star acquisitions they've made, those players are still there. A couple of them might not be soon, and they are a bit of a crossroads, really, because it comes back to the ownership. The FSG, when they sit around a dinner table in Boston, do they say to themselves, we can't compete financially with Manchester City and Chelsea, or do they say, we don't want to compete with them? In other words, our business is too big and broad for us to devote all our resources to this arms race with City and Chelsea. And if they choose not to compete with £100 million transfers, then it becomes a question of finding a formula, a different, cleverer formula beyond money that allows them to maintain parity with those two huge clubs, two rivals. And obviously, I think they know that they've got a fabulous front-of-house leader asset in Jurgen Klopp. And at the moment, they're relying on him, I think, to get them through any kind of short-term turbulence.
Do you think, Richard, that they've overlooked the need to strengthen in the transfer market over the last couple of seasons? And if so, a couple of questions, really. Is that partly a cultural issue because player movement is much more structured in North American sport, which obviously is FSG's, you know, key area of excellence and expertise and experience? But also, are we looking here at their need to really invest? And does that highlight then the significance of losing Michael Edwards at the end of this season as their sporting director?
I think that's a really good question. You know, when you look at the long-term planning over the years, you know, you have to say Michael Edwards has done a great job, not just with player sales, but with overhauling a squad, which was quite mediocre, to one that's winning leagues, Champions Leagues, and challenging for the title. And even after that, you can see they've made quite key strategic signings, you know, the likes of Konate, the likes of Diogo Jota, the likes of Naby Keita. Obviously, injuries are probably a mitigating factor there, as there has been with Thiago. You know, when he first joined, I thought that was a fantastic signing, and he's been unlucky with injuries as well. And then supplementing that with really good and exciting academy prospects, you know, the likes of Harvey Elliott, Curtis Jones, top quality young players who are already making an impact at the top level. But where I think there is an oversight is especially, you know, in the centre forward position. We know what Firmino brings to the team. but in terms of his goal output, it's not that high. So, you know, if Salah's not scoring, if Mane's not scoring, then you're looking at where the goal's coming from. And also in midfield too, I've mentioned the likes of Keita and Thiago, but not really replacing Ronaldo. An oversight now in terms of someone who was such a mainstay in that team, who I think was never present last season, to not replace him and his energy and his industry, I think it's been a bit of an oversight. Now, you talk about Super League and the factors which made, you know, FSG want to support it. Of course, you can see the reasons why. It's a closed shop. There's no relegation. It's guaranteed income, opportunities for income to even grow even more than what it is now. So you can see the reasons why they wanted to do that. And also, if you're looking long term, we know Michael Edwards is going to be a big loss for the work he's done. The Julian Ward assuming a position, you know, someone who's been at the club. But he has got a big job on his hands in terms of, you know, are Liverpool about to come to a cliff edge? You know, with Klopp leaving, with certain players' contracts coming to the end, he's got a big job to take Liverpool to that next level, you know, in terms of new manager, maybe, you know, overseeing the academy prospects and getting new signings in those positions where they are just a bit short of their main rivals, Manchester City and Chelsea.
Mm. You know, we know Liverpool is a club that has emotional attachment to their, you know, dynastic managers. It goes right back to the days of the boot room, doesn't it, Paul? You know, you know Sir Alex Ferguson well. Does the example of the vacuum created by his departure from Manchester United hint at some sort of danger to Liverpool when, as is inevitable, Jurgen Klopp eventually goes? It could even be in, you know, 2024.
Possibly. It's a much longer period we were talking about with Sir Alex Ferguson. Obviously, he was Manchester United. He just defined the club, didn't he, for two decades. Klopp's impact was to save Liverpool in a way from a period of kind of undulating form and fortunes. They'd slipped away, but he put them back on the pinnacle. First league title since, what was it, 1990, was it? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Champions League winners again. So the renaissance and the revolution is clear to all, and it was based on a top manager and some brilliant transfer dealings and a foresight about restructuring the club and the recruitment and so on. But when he goes, as he will go, does the club now have the foundations to maintain the success that he's achieved over the last 5 years? A few years, possibly, but I wouldn't bank on it, because that top six area is so competitive. You know, there's no divine right to finish in the top three, and they have to start thinking beyond Klopp, obviously, on some level. But I do think that they need to also get back into the market and try to strengthen what is a very good team. To me, the area where they've really pushed their luck for an awful long time is in midfield. It's remarkable if you compare their midfield resources to those of Chelsea and Manchester City. Liverpool have far fewer options. They're asking far more of the midfield players that they have. And they need to get in there and strengthen the two players I would go for if I were in a dream world and owned Liverpool FC would be Tielemans and Bellingham. Those are the two sorts of players, particularly Bellingham. I think they would move Liverpool on to the next stage.
Yeah, I think clubs will be queuing around the block to try and get hold of Bellingham as early as this summer. You know, going back to what you said about, you know, that front three, Rich, Mo Salah, would you pay him what he's asking?
I think you have to. I think you have a player there who, you know, he's at the peak of his powers. He's the best player in arguably the best league in the world, and he is proving his worth time and time again. And you do see it when he's not there, and it highlights that even more. So it would probably cost Liverpool more to replace him at this moment in time than to just give him what he wants. And the thing about Salah as well is that he's approaching his 30s, of course, but, you know, he's in great condition. It's a great culture at Liverpool in terms of how they condition their players and maintain that kind of physical capacity. And can see Salah maintaining his level for at least the next 4-5 years. And he has a technical ability as well that even if he was to lose his pace at some point, he could even alter his position and play in the middle or behind the striker. So you have a long-term value there. And as I say, it would probably cost more to replace such a talent than to just give him what he wants. He's happy there. His clubs are happy with him. So it just seems like a no-brainer, really.
Yeah. If you think more immediately, Paul, you know, following Thursday night's League Cup semi-final, they're at Crystal Palace in the Premier League on Sunday. Now, one Premier League title bid blew up at Selhurst in 2014. Inevitably, you know, prompts the thought, will another one blow up on Sunday? But I suppose, really, realistically, how many league games do you think Liverpool can afford to lose for the rest of the season?
Well, I'm going to start with none and go from there, I think, because they're, they're 11 points behind at the moment. And it's not just the points gap, it's the sense that Man City look unstoppable. You know, they've always been clear in their identity under Guardiola, but they just at the moment they seem intent on just crushing everybody. There's no doubt in the mind of that team. They go out there and treat every opponent the same way and dispatch them with this kind of coldness, you know, and confidence. And so to imagine Liverpool getting back at Man City, you have to imagine Man City faltering at some point over the next few months. And I personally can't quite see that, although it's always daft, really, to look at. We learn this lesson again and again. If you look at football as it is on any given day, you deny its, you know, its potential to be different in a week's time or 2 weeks' time. And teams hit bad runs, things go wrong, don't they? We've seen that again and again. But they'd have to go spectacularly wrong for City and phenomenally right for Liverpool for there to be any change in the current order.
Certainly. Now, you know, we look across the city of Liverpool, Rich, we see that it's not as simple in modern football as throwing money blindly at a problem. Everton, they've got Big Dunk, caretaker manager again. So much for their hopes of a quick appointment.
Yeah, I mean, Martinez was obviously muted and they failed in that pursuit. As has been documented by a lot of people now, you have to question the strategy there. You know, £500 million spent by Fahad Moshiri, five managers now, two directors of football. When Marcel Brands came in, I should say, things did start to look up in terms of you could see the kind of philosophy and what he was trying to do there. But as his influence waned, things started to go awry again. Look, Duncan Ferguson, he had a galvanising impact the last time he was at the helm. Everton could obviously do with that again, but they need more than that. They need a sense of direction. They need a sense of strategy. You know, they have too many players there who bought by different managers, different mentalities, different motivations, and it's going to take a bit, really big clear out. So maybe it's probably a blessing in disguise that they haven't maybe appointed too quickly. Hopefully this time for them, they're being more strategic in their planning, and hopefully for them, the next manager will have a more long-term plan in place to really overhaul the squad. And you know, especially if they're moving into a new stadium in a couple of years, you know, they want to be competing at a decent level at that time. So it gives them a couple of years now to regroup, hopefully rebuild from their perspective and go again. But I mean, at the moment, it's a bit of a mess.
Yeah. Do you think, Paul, that you know, there's a danger of over-sentimentality here again? You know, we look at the theory that a manager must know the club. Well, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer probably blew that one out of the water. Wayne Rooney inevitably is being mentioned. He's done a fantastic job in chaotic circumstances at Derby. But is he really no more than an impressive novice?
I think he is an impressive novice. I remember a few years ago when he was at Manchester United, a few of us were invited to lunch with Wayne Rooney, and he was what struck me about that was talking to him about his desire to become a manager when he stopped playing. Both kind of took us by surprise because I don't think anybody really expected it, but it was also noticeable how serious he was about it and how much he'd thought it through. And Alec Ferguson always used to say he was a very serious student of the game. You know, he didn't always appear that way, but actually he was always computing and noticing things and making mental notes, a bit like Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville did. And so went into management after he retired at Derby. It didn't really take me by surprise. I knew, you know, I had the sense of it being a long-term plan. And obviously by consent, he's an impossible job at Derby. If you want a, you know, if you want a kind of a trial of fire in your first managerial job, you go to a club in the mess that Derby County are in, and you know, everybody accepts that he's done a really good job. Now, then the question becomes, can he kind of trampoline from Derby County into Goodison Park and solve all the structural and cultural problems that have led them to the point where they are? I think it would be, I think he would do a decent job, but is it the right thing to do at this point for him? Almost certainly not, because I refuse to believe that he could solve the problems they have on his own, you know, in the 6 or 9 or 12 months he'd probably be given.
Yeah, if you're looking at other candidates for the job, Richard, Frank Lampard has been put forward. Will the fan base accept someone like him, who is a sort of traditional tribal bogeyman, isn't he?
Yeah, I think especially after the Benitez appointment, it probably would be the wrong way to go down. As I say, other names have been muted. You know, Sean Dyche, you know, is there potential for him? I mean, obviously he signed a new deal at Burnley only a few months ago. It's a really difficult one because we can't see the strategy. We can't see where they're going. I think sometimes with clubs, when there is a managerial change, you can see, you know, the processes they have in place. You know, for example, Villa, you can see where they want to go. So certain names kind of fit the mould there, and you can see that the general funnel process there. But in this situation, it could be anyone. But as Paul said, you know, the next appointment has a massive job on their hands to solve all the structural issues and personality issues that are there at the club at the moment. And it's going to take a really big experienced manager, but also support around him as well. You know, if they're looking for the director of football model as well, they'll need to get good people in place in the right positions to really make a good impact.
Yeah, I suppose if we're looking for an object lesson in how to develop a secondary career in coaching or management, you know, we shouldn't really look too much further than Steven Gerrard, an academy apprenticeship. Then he had a big club in basically what was a two-club league, now a Premier League club with ambition and, you know, financial reserves. How impressed have you been by Steven Gerrard? And do you share my sense that he's just getting hold of the club and the club are responding to his arrival with renewed ambition?
Yes, definitely. It's exactly what Aston Villa needed, really. A manager with energy, purpose, strength of character, ambition, and an imprint. I watch Aston Villa, and they're already an expression of Steven Gerrard's character, really. You know, you used to see that in the old days, where the team would resemble the manager, a bit like dogs and their owners, you know. and just occasionally in football, nowadays, you see it again. And Steven Gerrard, his influence is already apparent across the team, with its mentality, with his style of play, his kind of honesty. You know, he comes on after games and says, well, that wasn't good enough and we shouldn't be complacent. The defending wasn't right. He doesn't spare anybody's feelings. He's a very direct individual. But he has a vision, I think, of what he's trying to do. And his experiences, we're talking about, you know, forged in the fire, as Wayne Rooney has been at Derby County. Well, my God, the same is true of managing Rangers, isn't it? You know, if you can do that, you can, as an apprenticeship, you can pretty much do anything. But as you said, Mike, he did do other work before that. So he's on a fast track, there's no doubt about that. And fast tracks can come sometimes, you know, end badly, but everything he's done so far suggests that Aston Villa were completely right to think that he would be a really good long-term bet to change the club fundamentally.
Yeah, you've got some talk about Luis Suarez maybe following Philippe Coutinho into Villa. Have we got an Anfield reunion on our hands here, Rich?
It would be some creep, wouldn't it? I mean, unlikely, of course, but I mean, if there was a... little Anfield reunion. I'm sure the fans would be behind it, because it would show that the club's going in a new direction, and so it would be great for the fans, be great for the club if they were to make such a signing. And as you say, he would fit the Gerrard mould in terms of having that, great mentality, ambition, etc. So, yeah, I mean, what a signing it would be. I can't see it happening, but I mean, imagine if it did, it'd be great. It would be great for them.
I must admit, I'd love it. Absolutely love it. when you think about it, Paul, the fixture list is sometimes quite karmic, isn't it? On Saturday, in the Saturday lunchtime BT Sport game, you've got Villa going to Goodison, which means that Lucas Digne, who bewilderingly was sold in the dying embers of Rafa Benitez's regime, are going back to his old club, Everton. That's just a symbol, isn't it, of Everton's confusion and wastefulness?
Yes, it is. I mean, you give Rafa Benitez autonomy at Everton, you clear all the obstacles out of his path. He uses that autonomy to fall out with a very good fullback, who then gets sold to Aston Villa. Then you sack Benitez, and then the very good fullback comes back to haunt you a few days later. I mean, that's the circle of life right there. And it also reflects quite badly on Rafa Benitez, I think, in many ways, because he's still perhaps stuck in an era where you could and would fall out with players like that and take them on and win a power struggle with them. And really, in this case, it was to Everton's cost, because there's a player that should still be at the club. He's certainly good enough to play for them. And yes, it's a very good symbol of the confusion at Everton and the confusion that the new manager is going to inherit.
Yeah. Now, it seemed unlikely that Graham Potter's going to be that new manager. As usual, he was linked to the job. What about him, Richard? What's your view of him? He does seem, one, to make players better. You look at Trossard, for instance, and he can translate training ground theory into action. You look at that goal that Webster scored against Chelsea. He will keep getting linked to the biggest jobs, won't he?
He will do, yes. And it's credit to him. He obviously see that as a great compliment, but it's testament to the great work he's doing there at the club. As you've mentioned, he's made a number of players better on his watch. You mentioned Trossard, the likes of Dan Byrne is another one who just comes to mind, simply just because under Heaton, you're looking at someone who's maybe a bit of an average defender, but she's quite tall and fills a void. But this is someone who you slotted in different positions. I mean, when have you ever seen a 6'7" defender playing at left fullback and still impacting the game in a positive way? Yeah, he's done a great job. And as you mentioned, you can really see his imprint in any 11. And I think that's a sign of a good coach. They may need more cartonage up front, but when players are missing, their style of play does not change. He's flexible. He's able to change things in games and not lose that cohesion. So he's done a fantastic job. And I think when you're looking at, the top clubs are looking for managers and coaches to have their imprint. Now, he's one to really go for. And again, it's great testament to Brighton, to a fantastically run club, as Paul, I'm sure, will attest to. And the culture there just seems something, a place of great progression, great infrastructure, great in terms of investment in their facilities. You can really see it's a club which are trying to really develop all across the board. Looking at women's team, for example, as well. So Potter at the kind of tip of that iceberg, I think he's done a great job. And are they resigned to losing him? Probably, but he will leave them in a much better place than he found them.
Yeah, well, Paul, it is a club that you know well. What's the view of the fan base about the continual interest in their manager?
Nervous, in a word. and it obviously comes up with great regularity in the sacking culture of the Premier League. And every time it happens, Brighton fans get twitchy. I think they rationalise it now by saying, or trying to convince themselves, that there is no better club outside of the top six, or no better job, I should say, that Graham Potter might be tempted by, because, he's got pound for pound the best combination of people around him, and Paul Barber, Tony Bloom, the owner, and Dan Ashworth, who's still director of football. So, a manager would have to have a very, very good reason to leave that setup. when he's already getting plaudits and the team is improving and they're moving up the league and everybody's admiring him. So, you know, why on earth would he give all that up to go to a troubled club, an Everton, for example? The risk is that he gets so good and so admired that one of the big, really big clubs comes for him and he finds it impossible to turn down. But he's obviously, as we know, managers have to time this right. You know, if they go too soon, they can burn. If they go too late, they can stop making progress and everybody says, oh, he's gone off the boil. So it's all about timing, isn't it? But if in the future, you know, Arsenal or somebody came for him, that would be the test. But I think for now, it would be, there's no need for him to leave Brighton, where his coaching is remarkable. As Richard said, you know, the fluency of their attacking play, their approach play, the finishing isn't good enough at the moment. There's no question about that. But the defending and the approach play, the fluency of their football is really striking. And I bet there are some seriously good coaches around the world looking at Brighton thinking, how the hell does he do that? You know, and a lot of them probably want to get onto the training ground down here in Sussex to see what it is that Graham Potter's doing to get this team to play so fluidly.
Do you think he'd be a viable candidate for Manchester United?
I do, yeah, I do. Again, one of the questions is always, and we trot this question out, yeah, but could he handle the big players, you know, the £50 million players, the big personalities, the egos, the cliques? Well, nobody really knows until it happens. But anybody who didn't respect Graham Potter and didn't feel they could learn from him and work with him would have a problem. So it would be on the £50 million, £80 million players to consider themselves lucky to have him, really. I certainly think he'll be England manager one day.
Well, yeah, Manchester United under the temporary husbandry of Ralph Rangnick, there's always a sense, Rich, I don't know if you'd share it, that he's busy papering over some cracks. What about Cristiano Ronaldo? You know, frankly, that was an embarrassing hissy fit at Brentford on Wednesday night. Or am I being unfair? And was it just another sign of him as a perfectionist? Discuss.
Well, I mean, look, we all know what Ronaldo is in terms of his mentality and being a winner, but I think when you have that kind of seniority in the squad, you know, you need to set the tone and set the example. Now, we've seen him do that in a number of positive ways. I mean, obviously, there was a story about Abercrombie and all of that stuff and his approach to training, of course, which has, you know, which he improved. But, as you say, that is that kind of whole attitude, that whole demeanour. And there was, I don't know if you've seen the picture when he comes off and Mason Greenwood is almost looking at him as if to say, well, is that how big players act? Is that, you know, is that the way to behave? And in those kind of, you know, young players are sponges and they do take that in. And we're already talking of you know, there's cliques in the dressing room and mutiny and unhappiness there. And, you know, you do need to show that united front. And he's experienced enough to know that, you know, these things will get overblown and talked about as we are now. So, yeah, he's got to conduct himself better there, I feel. I mean, of course, no one wants to come off, especially in that time of the game. He wasn't playing well. Nothing was really coming off of him, really, apart from the chest pass for United's second goal. But, yeah, it's not the kind of attitude you want to see, especially from your senior players.
I thought it was interesting the awe with which Anthony Elanga spoke about him afterwards in his interview with Des Kelly. Paul, I don't know, United are a really baffling team, aren't they? As good as they were in the second half at Brentford, they were awful in the first, in which, funnily enough, Brentford covered 4.5 kilometres more ground.
Yeah, that's a telling statistic, and it just shows you that we can talk all we like about, you know, clever formations and genius coaches, godfathers of gegenpressing and all the rest of it coming in to kind of solve things overnight. But it's not just about tactical formations and theories. You know, it's about attitude and it's about commitment. It's about unity, all these human elements that we often ignore in this rush to just consider stats and formations all the time. So Rangnick has hit the same problems that all the other Man United managers hit, which is that there's a culture problem in that squad. And until the players start to realise collectively and individually what it takes to get Manchester United back to the top of the league and start looking at Liverpool and Man City, you know, the players are actually setting the example, then it's all just moving the deck chairs around, really. The Ronaldo thing was interesting to me because only a few days earlier, he'd given this quite welcome in many ways sermon about how the young players had to understand, you know, behaviour and demeanour and commitment and dedication, all the rest of it. And then a few days later, he throws a tantrum when he gets taken off for fairly sound tactical reasons. I mean, Ralf Rangnick did explain why he took him off. It was to make a tactical tweak in the side. So, unfortunately, Ronaldo, who's a fabulous player, and I admire him to the end of the earth, but he set an example to the younger players that he would, a week earlier, he'd said they shouldn't be following. So it was a bit bizarre.
Manchester United, they are a fish in a pretty big goldfish bowl. I thought Rangnick came across really well when he spoke about Jadon Sancho, Rich. You know, the precise quote was, he's playing for one of the biggest clubs in the world. This is psychologically, emotionally, much more challenging than Dortmund. I think a coach like that, you know, it's best to actually entrust the future of young players with someone like that, isn't it? Someone who understands, who's empathetic.
Yeah, I think so. I think, as you say, empathy is the right term here. Having that holistic approach, because it's very easy to look at, as you say, the stats, as Paul said, and, you know, the how they're playing eye test and things like that. But, you know, what's going on behind the scenes? Are we taking a holistic approach to these players? I mean, of course, look, they're in a lot, people say they're on a lot of money. They've been bought for a lot of money. They should come in and produce the goods. And, of course, you'd think so. But, as I say, he is, in the likes of Sancho, he's a young player. Obviously, you grew up in England, but has played his formative years in Germany. And it's a culture shock. I mean, when he first came, you know, he was even taken aback by the pace of the league and how, you know, quick and strong other defenders are. And it's something that he knows that he needs to improve on his perspective as well. But as you say, if you've got a coach there who recognises the wider picture, the bigger picture, and takes the holistic approach, I think it will stem put the young players in a good stead in the long run. But as you say, you know, fans and journalists, like, you know, want instant success, instant gratification. And sometimes with young players, you're not going to get that all the time.
You talk to people around Chelsea, and they all make a point of mentioning how thoughtful Thomas Tuchel is in terms of, you know, the way he, well, one, tries to get a better understanding of his players and the game itself. And obviously that's been recognised, you know, he's FIFA's Male Coach of the Year. Now, Chelsea, 1-7, Paul, but they have played 15 games since the start of December. Do you accept Tuchel's explanation that his team are simply mentally and physically tired?
I always have sympathy with the complaints of clubs during periods of intense fixture congestion, and this is one of them. I'm not one of these people who says just get on with it, but I think there are very few people outside of Chelsea who would look at that squad and feel any sympathy for them at all, particularly as he's a rotating manager anyway, to some extent. You know, he has the resources and he has the skill to bring people in and take them out, and he has all the sports science measures to work out who's ready and who's not to play. So it was working fabulously for him. Last summer, they won the Champions League, and then they started this season like a train, and their form began to deteriorate or level off before this period of fixture congestion. So I think he's using it as a deflection from the fact that the team have lost their fluency and their conviction and their confidence. They just do not look the same team that they were, you know, in September, for example. And that goes deeper than fatigue. It may be the familiar Chelsea problem resurfacing, that a manager gets a honeymoon period, in this case quite a long honeymoon period, and then starts to encounter familiar problems inside the squad. Or it may be that he has a number of individual problems that are all ganging up on him. I mean, in particular, you know, the whole Lukaku issue, I think, has been a really bad distraction for them. And that should have been spotted. If he didn't want Lukaku, as much as people say he potentially didn't want him, then that should have been dealt with long before now. I personally think that Chelsea under Drogba and Diego Costa had a model of play that worked. I know the game's moved on and we it's all about false nines now and so on, and centre fours, number nines aren't as fashionable as they once were. But nevertheless, I think that they could still have built the side around Lukaku, played through him, to him. He still looks like an isolated player now when he plays. And it just seems to me that the team now is unsettled and imbalanced, and they don't really know what they're doing anymore in the way that they did 5 months ago. And Tuchel's going to have to deal with that and put that right.
You can see the cumulative strain in the body language of obviously Lukaku, but I thought that exchange with Ziyech was very significant the other night, Richard. It was quite interesting that Tuchel said he was very confident that he can complete his current Chelsea contract, which is due to expire in 2024. That's pretty bold, given the club's ruthlessness, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, I think even Tuchel acknowledged that when he first joined, that he, you know, I think the question was put to him, and he did bat it away quite well. I mean, look, he has got credit in the bank, of course, but as we know, Chelsea are very ruthless, and when forms have started to deteriorate, especially with the investment in the squad and the size of the squad he's got, you know, the axe might start to wield. Although, as you say, I think the fact that he started off really, really well, I should say. Maybe, you know, in Tuchel's defence, you could say, you know, this run of games is a mitigating factor, tiredness, fatigue, etc. And when everybody's back fit and firing, things will be back to normal. I mean, obviously, he lost his both of his fullbacks, who were very important to his play. Obviously, unsustainable. You can't have your fullback scoring, you know, a high percentage of goals. That's just not right. But, you know, he would attest to the fact that if he has his full-strength squad back, Chelsea will be firing again. But at the moment, it's not looking good. As Paul said, the form was dipping before this run of games anyway. So it's up to him now to galvanise the squad and get them firing again. But, yes, it's difficult, especially as you mentioned, the Lukaku situation. It's he's not looking too great.
Yeah, Tottenham at the Bridge on Sunday, Paul. Going in on the back of that most unlikely of wins at Leicester, Steven Bergwijn, you know, two bids from Ajax before the game, two goals in 80 seconds at the end of the game. They're bound to be bouncing after that, aren't they?
Yeah, that was the sort of the ultimate Conte ecstasy, wasn't it? I mean, he's obviously one of the top 5 or 10 managers in Europe. But really, his currency is passion, enthusiasm, commitment, you know, work rate, intensity, isn't it? And he didn't have that at Spurs, let's face it. You know, Spurs were a kind of strolling, slightly half-hearted team when he took over. And the one thing you would back him to infuse into that team is the kind of emotion that we saw last night at the end of that game. And it was just pure, distilled Antonio Conte, that finish. And you know, with everybody going crackers at the end of the game. So, and then obviously the question becomes, can he sustain it? Is that the template now for Spurs? Are they going to do teams in the 89th minute every week from now on? You know, is there going to be this kind of buccaneering spirit there, almost a kind of underdog mentality in relation to the top four teams? I doubt whether it would last a whole season, really. It's quite hard to maintain, particularly with that group of players. But at least Conte, for now, is in his element. And at least Tottenham fans can feel that they've got a team who are going out to fight and win.
Yeah, when we talk about the Conte effect, OK, they've been unbeaten in 9 Premier League games under him, Rich. You know, let's just look at this coldly, if we could. They're 5th at the moment. They win their 4 games in hand over Chelsea. Now, they're comfortably in 3rd. This season's got a few twists and turns to go yet, hasn't it?
It does, as you mentioned, you know, the games in hand and the kind of skewed table that we have at the moment. You know, it does give teams an opportunity to gain ground. I mean, I'm always a fan of, you know, having points on the board. There's obviously no guarantee that they will, obviously, you know, gain ground, of course. But it's that carrot to chase, isn't it? And as you've mentioned, if they do pick up wins in those games, they are in 3rd. And everyone will almost say, how have they done that? Because, you know, they started quite poorly. I mean, even under a couple, barring last night, I think I'd probably look to the Liverpool game where they played quite well in a kind of Conte mould. But, you know, the rest of them, I'd say they've done okay. They've plodded along. But, you know, if they do end up in 3rd and are able to maintain it, then you'd have to turn around and say, Conte, had done excellently, from especially where they were when he took over. It would be a fantastic achievement. But whether they can recoup those points is another story. I don't think they will, but if they do, it would be fantastic for them.
Typically, Conte, Paul, has been pummeling the Premier League over the postponements, which, you know, frankly, have been a bit of a farce, haven't they? Looks like the Premier League are going to change the rules next month. Is that about time?
Yes. What started out as a perfectly reasonable idea became a sort of, as usual in the Premier League, it looks like you've had clubs trying to kind of snatch a yard, you know, and it's become a kind of competitive race, hasn't it, to get games called off. And the criteria for calling those games off have become very tangled and very confused, and it was becoming a bit anarchic. And I think finally they've woken up to the fact they need to have a strict set of rules in place and start again with it.
Looks like, I think it's 5 COVID cases and you're okay to call it off. That's about fair, isn't it, Rich?
I think so. I mean, if you're looking at the, you know, integrity of competition, then yeah, I do think that that's fair. But I mean, as Paul said, you know, I think, you know, when teams are kind of, you know, trying to gain that yard or using gamesmanship to, allegedly. It's difficult to tell, but and as I said earlier, I'm a fan of getting points on the board, because there's no guarantee that you will recoup those points if you are missing players. I mean, I know Leeds, like to Leeds and West Ham, got a lot of praise for fulfilling their fixtures, and I don't think they needed that much praise. I think that you shouldn't get praised for something that which you should do. It's up to the other teams to really try and fulfil that, really, and it's up to them. As I said, there's no guarantee that they will recoup those points. So yeah, it's I think you know, as you say, the rules that were there initially are fair, but you can see that they're being stretched to the limit now. So I think a new rule change couldn't come sooner.
You know, West Ham, and you know, let us not forget that David Moyes is back at Old Trafford on Saturday. You know, West Ham, a bit like Chelsea, are worn down by circumstance, it seems. How important will the international break be in restoring their focus and energy, Paul?
Oh, it's going to be crucial, because they're at the point, there's a crux here with them, where they're either going to have a fantastic season and finish, you know, in the top European places, or they're going to subside back down towards mid-table. I don't think they will, because I think the formula that he's got there, David Moyes, is very, very good. It's very effective. And he's got a very high number of his players, essentially, when they're fit and well, playing to a very high level. They're very difficult to play against as well, West Ham. They present you with problems that most of the kind of pure passing team don't always present you with. And I think it's to his credit, really, that he's evolved as a manager. You know, he's moved on in line with the way the Premier League football is now played, but he's still deploying a few old weapons and a few old tactics to kind of to get the players to believe that they are potentially a top six club. And for his sake, as much as anything, I hope that they're able to regroup and say, okay, let's plan for the last 3 months of the season, and let's make sure we don't waste the good work we did in the first half of the season, I should say.
Yeah, another club who've, you know, basically just gone on regardless, Leeds. You know, Marcelo Bielsa's philosophy probably is coming through there. Just throw a couple more kids in the mix. They've got Newcastle at home on Saturday. Is that, looking at this from a Newcastle perspective, Richard, is that a game they can't afford to lose?
Yeah, 100%. It's almost similar to the Watford game last week, really. These kind of six-pointers are coming thick and fast, and I think they'd have been really disappointed to not get the 3 points last week. You know, by all accounts, they played quite well, but it was just that concentration and that bit of quality at the back to see the game out that just didn't have. And you can see them getting unstuck at Leeds, I should say. As you say, Leeds seem to have been galvanised now. Obviously, great win at West Ham, of course, last week. And obviously, it gives them a lot of confidence after a bit of patchy form. So yeah, so it's a massive game. I think every game now is massive for Newcastle, especially with everything around them at the moment and then moving forward. But with how tight it is down there, they just need to just pick up points, because a couple of wins can see them dragged out of there. So it'll be a tough ask for them, but they just can't afford to lose. They can't afford to lose many games now, to be fair.
Is reality biting there, Paul? Because when you think of it, they failed to get their two main centre-back targets. You know, they're talking about shipping in someone like Lingard, you know, who should really turn up on a lifeboat, you know, for a six-month loan. What do you think will happen over the next 10 days or so? Do you think they'll start to shop like some sort of panic-stricken husband on Christmas Eve?
Well, there will be that temptation, because they didn't have a plan for this, did they? If when they sort of acquired the club by accident, almost, as I said before in this programme, it seems to me their first thought was, right, what should we do now? The Newcastle stayed in the relegation zone. They ended up in this January transfer window where it's always difficult, no matter how much money you've got, to buy players to do the job for you. And you don't want to be trying to buy celebrity players who don't want to come, or players who will come and just use it as a six-month, you know, kind of payday. So it is a very difficult thing to do. There's no question about that, no matter how rich you are. Chris Wood was a sign in many ways of how difficult it is, because they spent £25 million on a player I think had scored three times, you know. And so when the Saudis bought Newcastle, I don't suppose their number one ambition was to weaken Burnley, but that's the reality of the situation they're in. And yes, there will be a temptation to, as the closure of the window starts to approach, to just throw money at it and say, well, you know, this is it. This is our only chance now to save this team from relegation. No matter what it costs, we have to do it. Are they rational enough to think, well, if we go down, we'll put another plan in place so that we come straight back up, and this is a long-term thing. It's not about 6 months of panic and a kind of a dogfight to stay up. I doubt that, really. I suspect that they're making decisions day to day and week to week. But to answer your question, Mike, it wouldn't surprise me if there were two or three kind of short-term emergency big-name arrivals before the end of the month.
Yeah, well, today we've dealt largely with the business side of the game rather than the sporting side. I'd just like to end with a reminder of the game's humanity. Christian Eriksen wants to return to the Premier League in order to give himself the best chance of playing for Denmark in this year's World Cup. He died for 5 minutes representing his country in last year's European Championships. The heroism of the team's medical staff was marked in this week's FIFA awards. Now, a lot of clubs are understandably interested in him. Frankly, I don't care who he plays for, it will just be good to have him back. Do you agree? I hope so, regardless of which club you support. In the meantime, thanks to Paul and Richard for their insight, and thank you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.